10 minutes past 7 o'clock, time now to join Simon Marks, our US bureau chief in Washington, D.C., for the latest out of the U.S. Hi, Simon.
Hello, Justine.
Thank you so much for joining us here. Let's start off with news overnight that Jordan's Prince Hamza bin Hussein allegedly under house arrest, and the U.S. has weighed in and made a statement.
Yes, quite extraordinary developments over the last few hours in the Kingdom of Jordan, a country that traditionally is considered a very stable oasis in the Middle East. Certainly, that's the way the United States has traditionally viewed it. But there's evidently been some substantial drama there over the last few hours, because Prince Hamza bin Hussein, who is the younger brother of King Abdullah, and remember that King Abdullah is the son of the late King Hussein of Jordan. He's been running things since his father's death back in 1999. Well, now one of his younger brothers, Prince Hamza, has released a very dramatic cell phone video claiming that he and several other top officials in Jordan have been arrested, in some cases detained, in his case placed under house arrest. He says that his communications are rapidly being switched off. Indeed, he claims that he was only able to disseminate this cell phone video because of a satellite internet connection. That was his last connection with the outside world, and he feared that that was about to be turned off. He said that constructive criticism of government inside the kingdom is no longer permitted. He seemed to indicate that there had been actions taken against a number of other figures very familiar in Western capitals, including Bassam Awadallah, who is a former head of the royal court, certainly someone who is very well known here in Washington and in other key capitals around the world, because he's often traveled with King Abdullah and made arrangements for the king's various visits with foreign heads of government and heads of state. The United States very quickly weighed in on all of this, the State Department putting out a statement saying, "We are closely following the reports and in touch with Jordanian officials. King Abdullah," the statement goes on, "is a key partner of the United States, and he has our full support." So it's very unclear exactly what's been taking place. Did the royal household come to the conclusion that Prince Hamza and other top officials close to him, in some sense, were posing a threat to the stability of government in Jordan, posing a threat to King Abdullah's reign personally? One Western diplomat in Jordan, quoted in the Wall Street Journal, says more arrests are expected to follow. 20 people or so had been taken into custody as of just a few hours ago. So I think this is going to raise substantial concerns in Washington, where President Biden certainly will have met King Abdullah on numerous occasions in the past, and where successive American presidents, regardless of philosophical and ideological outlook, doesn't matter whether they were Democrats or Republicans, have always viewed the king as very much an honest broker, someone with whom they can engage in consultations and conversations about America's policy towards the Middle East. We know that the kingdom's been very hard hit by COVID-19 and the economic fallout from the pandemic, and also, of course, prior to that, by an influx of refugees from Syria, a substantial number of Palestinians who have made Jordan home in most cases for their entire lifetimes. They, of course, live in what are known as refugee camps, but to all intents and purposes are now permanent city settlements in various parts of Jordan, even though they maintain that they demand the right of return to the territory currently occupied by Israel. So this is going to be a big issue here in Washington and in other capitals over the next few hours and days, as I think Western governments seek to understand exactly what has given rise to this very, very unexpected and unforeseen set of circumstances in the Kingdom of Jordan.
And Simon, another worrying issue, of course, that Capitol building incident where Noah Green did rammed his car into that barricade. Flags now at half mast, and this raising those fresh questions about security around that area.
Yeah, no question about it, because as we were discussing yesterday, the broader perimeter fence surrounding the congressional building that had only been put in place back on January the 7th after the January the 6th attack on Congress by President Trump's conspiracy theory believing supporters. Well, sections of that perimeter fence had only just been taken down. And that's one of the reasons why the 25-year-old now deceased suspect Noah Green was able to smash his car into that security barrier at lunchtime on Friday. So I think there's going to be a big conversation in the days and weeks ahead about what level of security on a permanent basis Capitol Hill requires. Is that fence, in fact, going to become a disfiguring scar on the landscape here in Washington? And there are still questions about the motivation for what took place yesterday. We know that on Noah Green's Facebook page, he had described himself as the follower of Farrakhan, Louis Farrakhan, the head of the Nation of Islam. And yet police say they don't believe that this attack had terrorist motives. Mr. Green's family say that he had been extremely mentally and emotionally disturbed over the last few weeks, partly as a result of having lost his job recently, but also partly because of what they described as a period in which he had been having delusions and expressing delusions and delusional concepts to them. So they clearly seem to think that there was some kind of mental illness that contributed to what took place on Friday. There's a big political debate, of course, raging on social media with critics of the media saying that the media is seeking to excuse this by not focusing on the fact that he claimed on his Facebook page to be a follower of the Nation of Islam. But the fact of the matter is that the police themselves are saying that they don't believe that this was an act of terrorism. They think this was a lone wolf, someone that was not known to them and who appears to have been going through some kind of real mental crisis over the last few weeks. But look, the investigation is still in its infancy. We will learn more as police and the FBI continue to draw their conclusions about what took place yesterday.
Simon, let's switch gears now to Iran. Iran and the United States saying they will hold these indirect talks in Vienna from Tuesday as part of those broader negotiations to revive that 2015 nuclear deal between Tehran and global powers. And France now weighing in and saying that, you know, they're calling on Iran to show a constructive stance.
Yeah, the key word in all of this, of course, is indirect. One European diplomat was quoted by Reuters on Friday as saying the Americans and the Iranians are going to be in the same city, but they're not going to be in the same room. And it's also important to underscore that this is not U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken heading off to meet Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif. These are going to be diplomatic conversations, indirect conversations, between lower-level officials, with European diplomats shuttling back and forth from the room where the Iranians are sitting and the room where the Americans are sitting in a bid to try and advance things. Now, you know, let's be clear, all of this has happened very quickly. A week ago, we didn't know that we were going to be looking at these conversations in Vienna quite so rapidly. And that's partly due to the fact that Democrats on Capitol Hill have put tremendous pressure on the Biden administration, saying, look, Mr. President, we understand you really want to focus on all the domestic issues, COVID-19, the vaccine, economic stimulus. But there's a presidential election in Iran this June. There's a window of opportunity to act, and we ought to take it right now. So that appears to have focused the minds of the Biden administration and the State Department. We know the contours of the conversation. The Iranians want American sanctions lifted. The Americans say if Iran returns to compliance with the nuclear deal, from which, of course, President Trump pulled the United States, then the United States will also return to compliance with the agreement, and as part of that process, sanctions that snapped back into force when the Americans pulled out will therefore then be removed. But the sequencing of all of this is going to be very complicated. It's not dissimilar, to the notional conversation that the United States and North Korea might have one day. In what order do you do all that? And the Europeans really want to get this done, first of all, because they want the nuclear deal to remain in force, but secondly, because those sanctions that snapped back into force against the Iranians also put European businesses at risk of themselves being sanctioned by the United States if they carried on doing business with Iran. So everybody seems to want to get to a place where this agreement can go back into sort of full compliance and full effect. But as ever with these things, the diplomatic dance is going to be very delicate, and we'll have to see how they all get on in Vienna over the next few days.
You're listening to Asia First Weekend Edition with me, Justine Moss, on CNA 938, and I'm speaking with Simon Marks, our US Bureau Chief in Washington, D.C. Simon, we didn't touch on this yesterday, but let's talk about now the trial into the death of George Floyd. We understand that Good Friday had half a day of testimony, and in which a Minneapolis homicide investigator testified that Officer Derek Chauvin did use totally unnecessary deadly force.
Yes, it's pretty clear that heading into the Easter weekend, the prosecution wanted to give the jury something to think about over the weekend. And so Friday ended with that kind of climactic testimony from two separate police officers. One, the sergeant who was sort of running operations from police headquarters the afternoon of Derek Chauvin placing his knee on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes, by the end of which George Floyd was deceased. And then the other, this senior investigator, and both of them argued that Derek Chauvin had engaged in excessive use of force. And indeed, in the case of the senior officer, the investigating officer, he made the argument that, you know, even if you could claim that it was justified to place Officer Chauvin's knee against George Floyd's neck at the beginning of that 9 minute period, by the point at which George Floyd had clearly passed out, which is at about the 6 minute mark on that videotape. At that point, evidently, attempts should have been made to find out what kind of medical condition Mr. Floyd was in. And instead, what ambulance crews discovered when they arrived on the scene 9.5 minutes later was that Derek Chauvin's knee was still on the neck of a man whom the ambulance men immediately concluded was dead. That, of course, is building up to what is expected to be explosive testimony that is coming on the prosecution's behalf early next week from the chief of police in Minneapolis. And this is very, very unusual for a police chief to be going into court and testifying against a former member of his own force. And the police chief, we know, is going to argue that Derek Chauvin engaged in an inexcusable use of force at the scene of George Floyd's death. This is why the prosecution argues this case is open and shut. There was no excuse for Derek Chauvin's behavior. He must be convicted of second degree and third degree murder charges that he now denies. The defense, of course, is going to argue that, first of all, the Minneapolis Police Department procedures allowed for Derek Chauvin to do what he did. Secondly, that Mr. Chauvin and the other police officers on the scene were worried that they were going to be attacked by members of the crowd who were watching and berating them. And thirdly, they will argue that Derek Chauvin knew George Floyd was drugged at the time of his attempted arrest and was worried that after passing out, he might regain consciousness and then become violent again. So the defense is going to make George Floyd's drug use the central issue in this trial. George Floyd's family is already describing that as character assassination. But remember, defense attorneys only need to persuade one juror that Derek Chauvin had reason to act in the way in which he did, And that will see the former police officer acquitted, which is why Minneapolis is absolutely on edge, with security having been ramped up ahead of the testimony at the trial by the city's police chief.
Simon, let's just finish off with the federal investigators now looking into Republican Matt Gaetz's relationships with the young women. They've been examined as to whether any federal campaign money was involved in paying for travel and expenses for the for these women.
Yeah, this was the week in which the walls started caving in very rapidly for Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida. And for those who don't know who he is, he's a 38-year-old firebrand Republican, one of the most prominent vocal out there supporters of former President Donald Trump, as indeed he was when Donald Trump was president. And he now is in the crosshairs of a federal investigation that we learned this week the Department of Justice started before President Trump left office. So this was all kicked off under the stewardship of former Attorney General William Barr. The probe is looking at whether Congressman Gaetz had an inappropriate relationship, an illegal relationship, with a 17-year-old girl, and may have used campaign money or even his own money to travel that girl across state lines. And if investigators decide that they believe that's what he did, he will be facing very, very serious criminal charges, because that will be considered human trafficking by the Department of Justice. He denies it, says he's never had an inappropriate relationship with a 17-year-old girl, says he has never committed any kind of act that would see payments being made in exchange for any favors of any kind. But this story is moving rapidly. The New York Times has been investigating it, as has the Washington Post and other news organizations here. And you can see Republicans distancing themselves at a rate of knots from Congressman Gaetz just over the last few days. Indeed, his own communications director resigned on Friday, saying that he could no longer issue statements on the congressman's behalf. So it seems as though this investigation is moving apace. And that if investigators believe they've got a case to bring, then there is every possibility that Congressman Gaetz will be facing charges that would carry, on the face of it, some very, very severe jail time. So Republicans on Capitol Hill agog over this, and Democrats watching it with obviously considerable interest as well.
It's going to be an interesting week, and look forward to getting more updates from you next weekend. Simon, as always, thank you so much for speaking to us here in Singapore.
Thanks, Justine. We'll talk again on Saturday morning.